This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1981 classic directed by Michael Mann, Thief. This is the second motion picture directed by Michael Mann, with a screenplay written by Michael Mann and a story written by Michael Mann. This movie is based on a book called The Home Invaders by Frank Homener. It's produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, and it's starring James Caan, Tuesday Well, Robert Prosky, and Willie Nelson. Cinematography by Donald E. Thoren. Edited by Dov Hanig. Music by Tangerine Dream. And it is a Man Caan Productions and distributed by United Artists. This movie came out in March 27, 1981. It has a running time of 123 minutes. And it was made for a budget of $5.5 million. This movie made $11.5 million. How are you guys?
I am good.
I am really good.
He's lying.
Not slightly hungover.
What's new? What's new?
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat?
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Whoa.
Before we get into this, a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
We watched a man being very good at his job and then going psychotic every time he wasn't doing his job and taking it out on women and policemen and anybody who would care, and then going really mental at the end.
I take it that you didn't like Frank.
Oh, no, I love Frank, but he was quintessentially a bad man.
Yeah, he went scorched earth on everything. Yeah, full on.
It is safe to say, pun intended, that our protagonist is very, very good at his job. That's what you said. And I actually found him quite endearing as well. Very humane character. This was my pick. And it was the first time I experienced this movie.
That's crazy.
Same here.
It is. Yeah. It is. It fell through the cracks, pun intended. This movie opens with one of the most hypnotic sequences from a movie from the 80s. It is the entire safe cracking procedure. You can see how John McTiernan paid, you know, homage in this in Die Hard. You can see how Michael Mann repeatedly paid homages to this movie throughout his career. I adore that so much payphone action in this as well. It's great. We're really getting a kick out of payphone action lately. Mm-hmm. The movie looks fucking gorgeous. We watched the theatrical release. This movie was treated a few times. Apparently, the latest one is the one to watch. We watched the Arrow release, which is theatrical. Then Criterion released another version where Michael Mann went really to town on his blue tones.
Where did you go?
And I was going to say that's the release I saw. I saw the Criterion release.
You watched the teal one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they call it. It really pushes blue up quite a bit. I chose to watch the theatrical release because it had the original coloring from the 1981 theatrical release. So it has that 80s color. But, I mean, there was still a hefty dose of blue here. You know, he likes his blues and reds, but blue is definitely his signature in everything he does. I mean, even the titling in the opening credits of this movie, blue, you know, all the way through. I loved it, but that's what we're here to discuss today.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is Umba turned around and went, "What color is he associated with?" I went, "Well, blue." It's
like, yeah, because I knew the answer. I wanted to know if he knew.
Yeah,
that's that was a conversation. Then we went on to talk about, you know, I think Fincher's ambers and browns and Jean Carreau, an obsession with greens. It's and I like it. I like it. I think it's a cool thing for a director to do.
I just want to say, it's safe to say we had a cracking time watching this movie.
How many puns? What are we going to do here? What are we going to do?
I don't know. I'm the dad here, and I don't seem to have as many of these dad puns. So I feel I feel like I've wasted my time these past 7 years. Anyway, one thing that I find very magical about this film, being very early on in Michael Mann's career, is the fact that you can see a lot of scenes that are homaged later on. Very early on, you have the rain falling in the alleyway, and a year later, you get a similar rain sort of alleyway scene in Blade Runner by Ridley Scott.
I mean,
Coen Brothers as well paid homage to this movie in Blood Simple, for sure. The way the movie is framed is absolutely beautiful. Steve, was it Chicago?
Chicago. Yeah, I instantly turned around and went, this is Chicago. From there, isn't he? Really?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Because he you know.
I think this is the only film he's actually shot in Chicago.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, he knows the city well. And the thing is, the movie's gorgeous. You know, we are by the highway. We are in industrial areas. We are, you know, in dilapidated places in town. It's gritty. It's grimy. You'll feel the moisture, the cold, the rain. You'll feel the grittiness of the city and its unforgiving nature as well. Not to mention the fact that the portrayal of law enforcement in this is possibly accurate. Corruption everywhere. Everywhere. At the beginning of the movie, you know, at one point we both looked at each other going, is that fucking Dennis Farina? This is at the beginning of the movie. So Dennis Farina, and it's an actor, it's a character actor that I quite like. We see him in the police station in the first 10, 15 minutes. And then he hits back later. But this, you know, is another check of gun. Basically, everybody's in Leo's pocket. Everybody's in Leo's pocket. Everybody pays the cops. You know, and this is reiterated throughout the movie over and over again. But speaking of Leo, who's Leo? Robert Prosky. Holy shit, is villainous in this.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, it hits so hard when you see him play this character. Because if you're Gen X, if you're a millennial or an elder millennial, you remember Robert Prosky from 10,000 movies, usually family movies, usually Christmas movies, fantasy, or it's that kind of thing. He always plays like a very amicable character, you know, good natured. But in this, he's a real piece of work. There's a couple of lines uttered by him in this that are fucking brutal.
Look. I said fucking look at him. Look at what happened to your friend, because you got to go against the way things go down.
You treat what I tried to do for you like shit. You don't want to work for me? What's wrong with you?
And then you carry a piece in my house. You one of those burned out, demolished wackos in the joint? You're scary, because you don't give a fuck. But don't come on to me now with your jailhouse bullshit, because you are not that guy. Don't you get it, you prick. You got a home, car, businesses, family.
family, and I own a paper on your whole fucking life.
It's not just what he says. It's the way he says it. He says it so off the cuff, and he says it so jovially that even when he's describing to Frank about what he's done with the money in the third act, you're just like, you asshole. You're totally on Frank's side. Like, Frank told you you don't do anything with the money but produce the cash and give it to you. And he's like, oh, yeah, and then we've put some in the stocks and we've put some in the shares and, you know, you asshole. And it's the same exact way he delivers all of his lines in Mrs. Doubtfire, in Gremlins. And yet, in here, you hate him. You absolutely hate him.
He's such a piece of shit. And he's menacing. There's a bit, which is the two lines that fucking left a memory burn. They beat the shit out of Frank. He is on the ground, right? This is like they're kicking him, literally kicking him while he's down. And the camera is low, pointing up. So you're seeing what Frank is seeing, looking up while he's wounded. And it's upside down. So you've got Robert Prusky upside down, like he's looking at you and he's going, he's saying some horrible fucking shit to him and you believe it. You believe it. It's not just threat. You'll know that if he doesn't do what Leo wants, he's going to do something to his wife. Not to mention that there's threat. There's a hefty dose of racism in the threat. There's a hefty dose of misogynism in it. There's implications of rape and violence against women. All in two sentences, and they are fucking brutal. I just thought, how the fuck did he clear these past censors in 1981? But it's just that talk, that kind of talk. It's kind of almost, it's the kind of insulting that to this day still, when it comes down to this, it's too much. It was too much back then. It's too much 10 years ago. It was too much today. Mm. You know what I mean? To hear it.
Yeah. The entire section where you have Frank and Jesse. Going for the adoption.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
In the office.
Just like, oh my God. This is too much.
The whole scene could have been done in two lines, and it's right at the end where it's like, I came through the state. Where did you come through? The suburbs? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But you can see that he's spiraling. Like, he's, everything is getting out of hand for him. You know, like, if he's exuding any sort of control over actions that he's taken throughout his life at the moment, because that was taken away from him. You know, we're brought back into his past. He talks about being in jail for a considerable amount of time. The amount of exposition given here is all Koresnov. That I didn't find any filler in this movie. Not at all. It's super tight. Like, whenever there are conversations, the conversations are to give you expositions about the characters. And if anything, your mind kind of starts racing, thinking about, I want to know more. I want to know more about Frank. You want to know more about Willie Nelson's character, Oculus. Even Willie Nelson, man, he's not like a trained actor. And I love there's a genuine streak running through the meeting that they have, because it's a time in which, you know, even today, some people, most men, have a problem in voicing their emotions or whatever. These guys have a proper friendship, and he goes to visit him. And you think it's his father at the beginning. You think, because that's not given to you yet. You know, but you know that he's visiting because he wants to, and something important is to be relayed to him that he's sick. But he does all, Will Nelson does all the way with his eyes. Even, I think, the lack of classical training when it comes down to acting actually aided that scene, I thought.
Well, I personally, because Willie Nelson's discussion is about how people keep coming in and out of prison, including like the tricks who get used within the prison system, I started going, do we need the Police Academy theme right now?
This is Michael Mann's first directorial debut on the big screen. Because yep. I think he did I didn't know that his first movie was a TV movie. Mm. Can't remember what it's called.
About Running, was it?
Something like that. But this is his first feature. And man, this guy has such a career. Holy shit. He's 82 now, dude. I don't know if he's taking the lead in directing. I don't think he will be directing Heat 2.
That'd be a shame. But at least he's written it, you know, at least that's all him. But what's really great about this film, and also for anybody who's out there who's an avid film fan, is that you can sit down, watch this film, and then every other Michael Mann film, you see the same themes, you see the same setups. Yeah. Just the conversation in the diner immediately reminded me of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino in Heat. Yeah. And sitting down in that diner. He knows how to do
it. It's like he's perfected it over the years. You know what I mean? It's just developed this theme further and further. But this is a first effort. It's not like it's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. This movie should really tank in some places, and it doesn't. First act is tight, second act is tight, third act is tight, and the soundtrack by Tangerine Dream, it's fucking bananas. It's so good. So good.
There's an interesting bit about that. It was originally going to be just a blues soundtrack, and they turned around in editing and went, no, we need something like metallic. And it's a perfect soundtrack. It's really freaking tight.
It is very good. And I think it plays like it plays from beginning to end. Like the entire thing is it's just phenomenal. I mean, we're talking Michael Mann here. Don't forget, like I fell in love with him with Heat first, then went back to Manhunter. All in succession, yeah. Heat, The Insider, Ali, Collateral, Miami Vice, Public Enemies, and the list goes on and on. These are all in succession.
is this technically his shortest film?
Maybe, but look, even Miami Vice, it's a public wank basically, because it wouldn't have been without the charisma of the original two leads of the TV show, because that's the problem here. You know, it's akin to, with the difference that that's actually not that great either as a movie, but it's akin making Total Recall again and putting Colin Farrell in it. You're putting him against fucking you lost the battle before. Yeah. And I'll give you another example. So Miami Vice, it's actually a better movie than the original material.
Also, if anybody is going to revamp something like Miami Vice, because of his early career in TV crime, TV.
Including Miami Vice.
Dude, you know that there's some episodes, there's one with fucking Phil Collins in it. There's one with Bruno in it. There's one with Bruce Willis in it.
Nice. Yeah.
So the show launched a lot of careers, but the one with Phil Collins in it is fucking hilarious. He plays the bad guy in it. Because it's bad guy of the week, right? Yeah, yeah. That's what the show was. It's like Monster of the Week with X-Files. So it's... are we going to do something for Hulk Hogan? Now that he's gone, are we going to do...
No, I'm...
Thunder in Paradise?
I tried to make a funny remark on Facebook about Hulk Hogan on somebody's page. And they vilified me just because of Hulk Hogan's past. And I just kind of thought to myself, whatever, because Ozzy was a saint. Sure.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And I agree. I actually had to, I shut someone down immediately. Someone younger.
Yeah.
All right. Someone like late, early millennial, not an elder millennial, but some, you know what I mean? Just on the verge of being Gen Z.
Not a boomer like us, right?
No, I'm not a fucking boomer, dude. I'm a Gen X. I'm Xennial, actually. Actually, here we got Gen X with Steve. You got Xennial with me. 77. I'm right over the border.
I'm a millennial. I am a millennial.
So, you know,
I want to be a Gen Xer. I really want to be a Gen Xer, but I'm a millennial.
I know. Yeah, but you are at heart.
Yeah,
you are at heart.
Yeah.
And in regards to someone immediately brought moralism, and I'm as if I leaned any further left, I'll look like the fucking Tower of Pisa. So, you know what I mean?
but Umba, it depends what side of the Tower of Pisa you're.
See, put a perspective, right? But I'm saying, you know, I'm as liberal as I can, but I don't like that fucking virtual signaling bullshit. Because at the end of the day, if you don't understand what I'm, you know. I'm saying, I even said, like, rest in peace, dot, 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 brother.
Yeah.
And some people saw brother as, because I don't know that that was a signature fucking thing that he ended every sentence with. They saw it as, like, my kinship with Hulk Hogan. It's like, what the fuck are you? No. What are you?
You should have been like, I do steroids exactly like he did. I mean, come on.
Listen, the thing is, I felt like I had to do that because him, Roddy Piper, Ultimate Match Warrior, Man. Andre the Giant. This is the wrestling I fucking grew up with.
Yeah.
And it's when these guys were larger, like it still are, but they, you know, that legacy carries on.
What I don't like about it is that everybody's bringing in the real personality, the realness of wrestlers to the forefront, as in, can you believe they're Republican? Can you believe they're a racist? Can you believe he took steroids and he lied in a court of law to save Vince McMahon's ass and all this stuff? And I'm just sort of like, can you believe he's an actor?
Because there's a long list about him.
But I'm like, can you believe he's an actor and I really enjoyed his character and he really changed the face of professional wrestling? Because if it wasn't for him, professional wrestling wouldn't be on Netflix right now. Like, nobody would care. But if it wasn't for him, the Ultimate Warrior, Bret the Hitman Hart, Andre the Giant, all of these names. God, I could keep on going. The model Rick Martel, you know, the Mountie. All of these names that are in my head shaped the youth that we grew up in. You know, they are staples. Roddy Piper would not be in Hell Comes to Frogtown, would not be in They Live. There wouldn't be this love for showmanship and soap opera if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan.
Actually saw it, like I didn't even manage to finish it because it was heartbreaking. Just because also it doesn't look well. There was a tribute reel on social media, so he filmed it with his phone. What's the name of that wrestler that goes woo?
Ric Flair.
Ric Flair.
He's very ill.
He's got like a massive gouge on his forehead. He looks like he's not going to make it for a long time, dude. I think he's on his way out.
Yeah. The only thing I would say about Ric Flair to like connect on to like wrestlers, characters versus who the real people are is that, Ric Flair currently goes to a lot of bars, drinks himself under the table himself. He doesn't need anybody to drink. Yes. And he shits himself constantly.
Oh my God.
Yes. He is very ill. So that is my absolute rant about why wrestling should be part of the fabric of society and stay on Netflix forever.
No, so we'll, rest in peace, Hulk. And now I'm looking at my notes that I didn't write because this time around it's just a printout of a bunch of factoids and stuff like that. But the second line of the plot is highlighted in blue, and it just answered a question that I had all the way through the movie. It's like, why are we seeing this now? And now I understand it. While we're watching the movie, you know, you get all these greedy shots of the city. Like we said earlier, it's great. At one point, we get this long take on a bus. It's like a Greyhound bus or something like that. It says on the front of the bus,
Des Moines?
Des Moines.
Des Moines, Iowa.
Right? And Des Moines, Iowa. You saw that as well. And the moment I saw it, I thought, why the fuck are we showing this now? Why are we showing this now? And I can't remember if we get the payoff later.
No, we don't get the payoff.
We don't. Okay.
But what's great about that scene is everything that leads up to it and everything post it. So the fact that that tracking shot is so long gives you the reason of why they've chosen that night to do that big heist. Because they've sent the cops on such a wild goose chase that they're leaving the state. So they've got enough time to get started.
Yeah, you're right. And also, man, we were talking about it all the way through. Like, I love the subtlety. This movie doesn't hold your hand. It doesn't have to. No. It really speaks in harsh tones to you about this criminal world. And there's the practice of how the deal's going down. They meet the first guy, which, by the way, had no neck and looks fucking... He looked like a Man in Black character. Gag. You know, when we saw him, we all looked at each other going, well, look at this fucking guy, man.
Like, it's Vincent D'Onofrio. Didn't you recognize him? It's Vincent D'Onofrio.
Edgar, what on earth was that?
Sugar.
I've never seen sugar do that.
Give me sugar. In water.
Hey, your skin is hanging off your bones.
Oh, yeah. Is that leather?
Dude, have some salad, for fuck's sake. Just eat some salad, mate.
He's too busy with his deep dish Chicago pizza, mate.
Oh, my God. He looked like the picture of fucking obesity. And no, but he just looked bad. No neck, weird fucking glasses. Like, he looked like a Man in Black character. Like, some, like an alien inside a fucking human suit. But anyway, and they do the exchange, right? So... I love the fact that he goes that very careful. They are very careful without fear. It's just, this is how business is done. He goes to meet him. Diamonds are exchanged. No money exchanged on the hand in. He leaves. Then his partner, which is James Belushi, which is possibly the only time I've seen him in a kind of semi-serious role. Like, he's not here for comedic effect at all. And he does well. He does well. He reminded me of John Cazale's character in The Conversation. And then he makes the call because, you know, the plot develops, something happened to Guy, because this was a setup from the beginning. That's the idea. We're going to get the best to do this job. We're going to get what he gets for us. We're never going to fucking pay them. And we're going to burn the ground around it. In fact, in the opening shot, they go through, the camera's fixed on Frank cracking the safe. As soon as he opens, swings the door open, he starts looking for something with intent. And before he gets to what is there to steal, he throws drawer after drawer behind him. And that's unusual behavior for a thief, because there's valuable shit in there. There's loads of rings, there's loads of jewelry, there's cash, there's a bunch of stuff. And he's flinging this stuff out of the way because he's there for a reason. One reason and one reason only. And we looked at each other going, holy shit, I love this. I love the fact that he's being paid to do a job here. He doesn't want to risk any of these things leading back to him. Because basically, if you know, even if you go to a fence or whatever, the more you sell, the more it can be traced to whatever crime was committed. Because then there's so many sources. It's just not ideal. And it's very professional. They do it in a very, very professional manner. So I really, 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 really like the insight that we got into this world.
Not only that, with that first scene, but just the camera work, you can see that they've used the real equipment and they've taken, probably best way to describe it, they actually sought thieves to talk through how this stuff was actually done. So they've actually taken people with the experience, shown them how it exactly works, and they do this perfect job. They use the same tools. You can tell straight away that he's a proper thief in the sense of, you know, he's using the tools, he's being methodical and practiced, it's going straight through. And then just that one section where you get to see the camera go into the hole, and I was just, wow, this is perfect. This is really, really, really perfect. Just the filming on this is absolutely spot on. I mean, color work, grading, everything, just perfect. But story's told completely from a perspective. There's hardly any words in that first sequence.
Mm.
And it's great.
Just that thumping, pumping fucking soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like I it's been a while since I enjoyed like some proggy kind of ambience in a movie, and this one is really, really good. Mm-hmm. Like, it reminded me of the soundtrack to Near Dark, which is also by Tangerine Dream, I think.
Yeah.
So it's, they know how to make a score, man.
There's so much to be said about not only the script, but the story through the editing, that the only times that we see Frank really lose it is when things are out of his control. The first time you see it is when he's late for his date. Because he's late, so when he gets to Jesse, she's basically passing out from having too many drinks. And then it turns into this almost manic, you gotta come with me. And then that weird conversation where he ends up saying,
"You sell little fucking cars, that's what you do.
I wear $150 slacks, I wear silk shirts, I wear $800 suits, I wear a gold watch. I wear a perfect, D, flawless, 3-carat ring. I change cars like other guys change their fucking shoes."
Everything is out of his control, and he can't bring himself back together. And those elements start showing themselves from the third act.
He's being candid with her, though. There was that sequence in the diner. They are putting things on the table, both of them, because she's talking about... What I picked up from the conversation is that passing Bogota or whatever the fuck it is, where it sounded to me like she's been a drug mule. She's been a prostitute at some point. Steve picked up on that. It's a city environment. It's a city story. And yet I gave a shit. I gave a shit about these characters. And you do in Heat as well. Fuck, man. The protagonist and the antagonist, they switch roles continuously in Heat, you know? And I think that's the reason why Michael Mann, because this is out of Pacino's mouth, he was chipping coke. He was chipping coke through the shoot of Heat as well, because he had an agreement with Michael Mann. He wanted the character of that Pacino plays to be on edge, literally. And you can see it. You can see it, because you can't act that out. And then years later, Al Pacino was doing an interview. I don't know if you saw it, and he tells the story. He tells the story of, and he actually even left. So he grew, like he actually grew a long nail on one of his hands. So because it's a mark of someone who cheaps coke with it, basically. It's
you do know that Al Pacino turned down the role of Frank for this movie.
Oh wow!
And Jeff Bridges and Jeff Bridges was originally going to be Frank in this movie.
You know what? They also would have done well.
Yeah,
I mean, not to take anything away from Khan.
Yeah, no, Khan was perfect for this because you needed somebody who, you know, you couldn't trust to be always on the level because they've always got an ulterior motive. One of the things I left from this viewing was realizing how transactional all of Frank's relationships were. Every relationship is transactional. Even his relationship with Jesse is transactional.
Yeah, because he wants to go straight. So she's the bridge to the family, the kid.
Yeah,
you're right.
But what's really interesting about this is that he hates it when someone is being obviously transactional with him. It's like, yeah, I said you get all that. Doesn't really work for me. So I'm going to do it my way, like I always do. And you're just going to have to follow my way. And it just triggers his like OCD or whatever's going on with him.
Yeah, because he's fucking with his plans, right?
Yeah.
This was meant to be his payoff. This was meant to be his way out, technically. You know, until he runs out of money and then he had to take another score. But the idea is that he had it all planned out. And usually, you know, he doesn't want to go back to jail because he's been there for a long time. There's all these things that he's got in his head. The hypocritical nature of it all is that if you decide to go straight, you go straight. You don't do another job, which is the biggest job you've ever done, to go straight when you go caught for something lesser, if you know what I mean. So the chances of you not fucking, it's massive. And I get it, you know, like it's a trope. It's the trope of one last score, you know what I mean? And that never pays off. I can't remember a single movie where one last score pays off. Not the last score, you know, they always have a dramatic ending. But if anything, this is an anomaly, this movie, because he does fucking get up and walk away at the end of this.
He does. And
he burns it down.
But
he burns it completely down, and he destroys his dream. But the crumpling of his image board and throwing it in the gutter.
Oh, the little, which is equivalent of a modern vision board, right? The postcard with his.
Yeah.
That was also endearing.
It's great.
You know, I mean, and he carried it in his wallet every time. There's a couple of moments in the movie when he looks at it again to ground himself, you know. There's also, you know, like the greedy nature of the city and how grimy it looks or whatever. I don't know how the fuck Michael Mann does it, man, because there's several different locations.
Lots and lots of water.
Yes, but there's in, which is not Mann, but the playful kind of exchange on screen between blues and reds. We saw that in Glengarry Glen Ross, which is a movie, again, that pays homage to this as well, for sure. One last score again. But in that, you have two locations. Here, there's a diorama, man. There's a diorama of Chicago in 1981, and it does it so fucking well. And even ugly, cheap, fucking vulgar places, like the parking lot of a, what is it? He's a car salesman as well, by the way. And there's nothing cheaper, right? At a commercial level, if you look at any kind of business, that is the one that it's, you know, it's just vulgar. It's just, you know, you don't trust a car salesman, particularly one from the 80s. I don't know what it is. It's like the trope spawns from there in my head. And every single shot of those parking lots look amazing.
Yeah.
Also, the interplay between background and foreground and what's in focus here with the camera moving between subjects, it's fucking incredible. The blocking is so fucking good. When he goes to meet her, you said that earlier, Ricky, when he goes to meet her in the blues club or whatever it is, and she's had too many drinks because she's been there for a while and waiting for him, he's late. And I love the fact that the camera follows him all the way through from the moment he enters the door. There's no cuts in that sequence. The camera follows him through the crowd, through the stage, through the crowd to her as he's making his way to her. And it seems simple. It fucking isn't. You got to get the blocking right for all the extras. Nobody's pulling focus either because the camera's just tracking. And you can see it going over shoulders and heads and it works. It works. By modern standard, it would be a headache to do anything like that. And also, there's not even like this. There's no place for a shot of the magnitude with so many people involved in a movie like this.
Big swing, man.
Because it's well made. This movie's well made.
And, you know, all hats off to the cinematographer and all the hats off to Michael Mann. But, you know, you've mentioned a couple of things there. There are scenes in this where it's the same Wes Anderson symmetry. So, you know, it's like the vault door.
Yep.
Or even the one I was thinking of was the office he goes into after he knows he's been screwed over on the first job. And there's a shot of everybody just working, but it's actually a symmetrical shot. It's like taken behind like three desks. It's so spellbinding. It's almost as if they're robotic because of the way it's been shot. And it makes what he does, where he threatens somebody with a gun, it makes what he does actually feel very professional because he's slipped into this very robotic world, it's basically a front. It's a front.
Yeah.
He slips into this, does what he has to do, and technically slips out again with, it's a bit of an absurd scene because everyone's seen his face and everybody knows like what he's done. And he's just pointing guns at anybody who even like looks at him. But it makes so much sense that he would go in there, be as professional with a gun
as he is
with a safe, and just be able to enter into these worlds and leave these worlds. Because he knows that no one's going to say anything about him. Because they are dodgy themselves.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I want Steve to tell us if he worked out why. This is a time in which cars were still, you know, metal and vinyl or whatever the fuck. And there's the hidden panel where the guns move. Like, oh, yeah, that's great. That's what that's for. That's what hidden panel. That's what you put in there. You put two guns in there.
Yeah.
So as soon as we see the two guns, fucking Steve starts going, that's...
I couldn't figure out the other one.
Okay.
But which is also a cult, but it's an extended barrel.
any reason why he had a preference? Because he uses the second gun later. He chooses the other one, not the first gun. Do you know why he had those two guns at different calibers?
One of the reasons is the other gun, the black one, which he uses later in the film, is an extended barrel. It's hard to actually place in a jacket or a coat or anything like that. Mm. So, yeah, so he's picked the Colt's, which is a chromed combat Colt. But, yeah, it's Commander. Yeah. Yeah, it's a Commander. But, yeah. But
wow.
It's really
so
nice.
So there we go. He had a Commander and he couldn't put the longer gun down his pants for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
You know, the barrel would get in the way of, you know, where your penis has got to be. That's right.
Yes. And they're trying to have a child.
They can't have a child. There's no. Other boys.
It is interesting because in that sequence as well, he does do a brass check on that.
Excuse me. What's a brass check?
Basically.
Mr. Wilkins.
So when you cock a gun,
when you do what?
Especially when you cock.
When you put your cock in a gun. Yep.
So what he did, it's how people are taught in the 80s to do that. So, but later on you don't do it like that anymore. But
to do
at
what?
That time, when you pull the slide back, and he's got his finger underneath the actual barrel. To do a brass check to see whether it's actually clicked into place, but you don't really need to do that anymore because, and even at the time.
Well, but if you had like an older gun,
it's an older style of doing that.
But brass check, you mean to see if there's a bullet in the chamber?
So
brass, you're referring to
bullets.
I think
it's to make sure it's cocked so that all the things are in place.
So once it's in place. So you when you slide it back and you basically put your finger under the barrel to make sure it's clamped. That's it. Oh my God.
He's talking about foreskin now. That we've moved on to foreskin.
It's all euphemisms, man. Basically, cocked. I think we covered a lot here, but there's one thing that I want Ricky to talk about, which is the adoption sequence.
The adoption sequence is harrowing. There's two adoption sequences. There's the first one where there is just a lot of banter that just turns ugly, and it turns ugly over and over again. There's a lot of terms and a lot of slights that get thrown around that is acceptable, I guess, in the 80s, but it won't be acceptable nowadays. But I found actually the conversation with Leo about the black market, families, they're not good enough. Who's going to say anything about a child moving this way or that way? And that was very harrowing.
Yeah.
And that's what he goes for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The entire exchange with the baby, with the lady just fucking coming downstairs with the baby through the back door.
During that conversation with Leo, he's just like, can it be a boy?
Reminded me of John Goodman in The Big Lebowski when he goes, you want a toe? I can get you a toe. You want a baby? I can get you a baby. Fucking. Yeah.
Oh, talking man. About receptions of awful, awful, awful conversations. This one star review, and there's only one of them, was presented in April the 5th, 2023. Hi guys, how we doing? How we doing? We're all good? Yep. Okay. So, James Spader here with this one-star review, and it's by Ajalpert. It says, uneven script and editing. This movie is geared for an 8th grade mentality and hard to understand why it's currently receiving decent ratings. It's poorly received when it was first released, and I can see why. I liked James Caan in several other films, but in this film, his character is not someone I find the least engaging. The mob boss has the only redeeming performance and is quite convincing, but that's it. Don't waste your time unless you are like watching a few bloody scenes filmed with ketchup. The movie tries to shock the audience, but the shock treatment has no support whatsoever, with the exception of an upside-down threatening head of a mob boss. Thank you, H. Albert.
That's the sequence that we were talking about, the upside down. Yeah. And Robert Prosky's monologue. What a piece of shit. What's this guy's name?
Oh, I believe it's Ajal Pert.
I kid you not. 1 star. This film is worth 2 stars out of 5 just for the fucking color grading.
Wow. I thought you were going to just stop there, Ad. This film is worth 2 stars out of 5. Dun, 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 dun. Before we move on to ratings, there is one series of shots I want to talk about that blew, like, so we didn't go over our history with this film apart from that this was the first time you guys seen it. The last time, the one and only time I saw this was when I was 14 years old. And at the time, I was like, an 18? Ooh, I'm going to go watch an 18. And then halfway through was sort of like, oh, 18s don't just mean nudity. Okay, I'll keep up with this film. So my 14-year-old mind was definitely focused on one thing. Tits. But
you went to see Beef because you wanted tits?
I was watching it at home at like after 10 o'clock on TV being like, oh, it's an 18. And then being like, yeah. Oh, there isn't any booby shots. Oh.
I have that relationship when I was much younger with Blue Thunder. There's a sequence in that movie. remember the opening sequence with it.
Yeah. I can tell you now, and I don't care that this gets projected across the world, that film 4, at a certain time when it first came out, Betty Blue. Ooh, Betty Blue.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
But I did not remember of the sequence of shots that is mainly editing, but around Jim Belushi sitting there on the stairs trying to get a radio frequency to get the password. That is a blinding scene. Yeah. Every shot is meticulous in that scene. And then I also want to connect it to the fact that the shot within the vault, where there is only light coming from the front of the vault, but you can see clearly everything going on in the vault. Like they must have had like one light so that all the diamonds and crystals showed off their rainbow colors as they were being shoved in. But that was a beautiful scene that you could barely see anything in apart from the diamonds and Jim Belushi's silhouette. Those scenes make this one of the best films about learning about cinema and cinematography and how things should be done.
For sure. And also, we talked about how Michael Mann throughout his career paid homage and developed this theme further and further, right? Showing several different facets of the, you know, greedy criminal underworld and the figures that operate within the world. Giving us insight, by the way, because it's believable. There's a level of realism that he brings to, you know, if you remember even his take on Manhunter, it just brought it into the real world. There's a much, almost like a supernatural edge. The idea is that it feels that greediness comes from, you know, even if you look at Heat, that shit actually happened. That entire, like walking down and fucking main a high street and killing several, you know, dozens of cops with automated rifles. That actually happened. And but anyway, we're not talking about Heat. He makes movies that are grounded within the real world, but these tales are larger than life. And he manages to stay grounded when he tells these stories. So it's a rare skill, you know.
In these stories that are they're all realistic stories, but there's a beauty and simplicity to them that when you show them on big screens with certain lighting and certain editing, you just feel a part of it. You are as paranoid as Jim Belushi is as he's on the radio on the cams trying to just find this one word to like bypass the final alarm system.
And you know, besides him basically paying homage to his own work and develop those themes further, is a huge amount of influence on modern works by a lot of people. And I'll give you an example. The shot that you described now, the opening sequence of this movie, has a lot of innovation in it. There's the entire us being shown how to crack this safe. We go inside the mechanism of the lock at one point, and it reminded me of a staple of modern RPGs along the likes of Skyrim, along the lines of Oblivion, along the lines of Fallout, you know, the lock picking. Mm. Not to mention the fact that all of these allegedly were originally in a video game called Thief. If you remember, Thief had the lock picking mechanic.
Yeah.
I think that then was patented to other studios, to other games, and now it's a thing. But that's what it reminded me. And there's no way that this movie did not inspire that.
Mm.
There's no way that this movie is not responsible for that. It was another instance in which is rare, but when it happens, I'm saying I feel bad, but it's bittersweet because it means that I just watched something worthy of our time. I can't believe that I haven't seen this before. I just can't believe it. And I think I picked this because there's been a resurgence on social media. There's, for some reason, people have been talking about Thief. I think it was Ryan Coogler as well.
Mm.
In his Criterion Closet thing, that he mentioned the movie, and I went, Michael Mann, Thief, inspiration? Fuck, I need to watch this. And then seeing the post, I was like, oh yeah, I was aware of this, but somehow I never watched it.
Yeah, I recently watched a Quentin Tarantino bit, but he was talking about Thief. It was about five mm-hmm. months ago, because he does that little like cut down snippet of movies and stuff.
He is fond of James Gunn, because he loves Rollerball. Ratings?
Yes,
ratings. Yeah.
So, this movie is an 8.5. I don't want to go any higher. I don't want to warp the expectations of people that may have not seen this and are walking into it for the first time based on our recommendation. There's one thing that Michael Mann tends to do best is to make movies that have pivotal sequences or are mainly flavored by the night. Hence why blue really works for him. You know, most of the defining sequences in his movies happen at night. And this is because he does have a good relationship with crime and grittiness, and crime, usually, that this type of crime takes place at night, in the cover of night. So the shadowy figures that operate in this underworld, you know, that we're brought into in every one of his movies, operates at nighttime. And I get why this shade of blue is there. You know, it's like a, what can we call it? Because it's a very Michael Mann blue as well.
Yeah.
It's got like a particular tone. So let's call it Michael Mann's blue, right? James Gunn's performance is phenomenal, but also, and this tortured me throughout the movie because I didn't want to pull out fully.
Talking about his full skin again.
Oh shit, I'm a father now. So Jesse, Tuesday Weld. Now, I didn't remember her name, but I tortured Steve as well because every single time she was in frame, I kept saying to him, holy shit, man, she looks so familiar. She looks so familiar. She looks so... And I'm pretty sure that she is very familiar. I'm pretty sure that she populated 1,000 TV shows that I watched in the 80s and 90s. I wished she got a sweeter deal as an actor, as a female actor, as an actress, because she's really good in this. She doesn't get a ton of screen time, but she's very believable. You can see her stepping in and out of interest with this man throughout this movie. I liked all the characters here. Even the fucking piece of shit cops, which we meet for a moment. Their names were Detective Borexco, Detective Ansel, Detective Martello, Detective Bukowski, and Detective Simpson. And they are all pieces of shit.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that would put a bag of coke in your jacket or they would put a gun in your car and fuck you over. So the most corrupt, disheveled, unwashed cops ever, and all of them are on the same page as well. There's a couple of sequences in this. Like they are dumbfounded in the police station because all of a sudden there's one criminal that doesn't want to play this game and they are dumbfounded and you believe it. You believe this kind of setting in which, what are you, like, they look confused, you know what I mean? As they're beating the shit out of him, they're going, I can't believe you fucking, why are you making us do this? Just fucking pay us. It's believable. It's an 8.5. Seek it if you can, because I am going to take a look for it. I'm going to keep my eye out for it. There's a 4K transfer, a new 4K transfer by, I think it's Criterion again, that reissued it, that apparently it's better than the last transfer from 2K negative. I know I'm alienating all of you if you don't give a shit about, you know, transfers or resolutions or whatever, but it is a gift. I perceive it as a gift whenever we get to watch movies from that era that are transferred to modern media correctly and by the people that were behind the original work. It's a work of love. It's like I can show you what my eye was seeing when we shot this, you know, and when it's done with love, again, I talked about it before, Synapse release of Suspiria. Go fucking look for it, and then you'll see what I mean. It's mind-blowing. By modern standards, when you get to restore work from that era now and bring it back into this world without it looking fake, it's dazzling. It's rare, but when you see it, it's amazing. So it's an 8.5. It's an 8.5 black market adopted babies.
Oh, man, you took mine.
Aha! Thievery! Aha. See, I stole it!
So, again, another 8.5. I think I just used the same one that I've been showing for the last 3 weeks. We've had some absolute freaking corkers on this run so far. I really want to say that this movie is just beautiful to watch. It's truly, it's getting up there to be one of my favorite Michael Mann movies. I'm dead serious when saying that. With everything from Heat and everything else, which is a solid movie with great performances. But this just, it feels more real in some respects. And I'm going to give it 8.5 Jim Belushi's being shot by a shotgun.
Oh, shit. Nice. Which, by the way, sorry, but because we didn't touch on it, when it happened, I was like, oh, shit, it's gone against trope and, you know, making a pretty strong statement, which is, you know, the platitude of no honor among thieves.
Yeah.
The fucking guy dies not to give his friend's name away.
Yeah.
And they're thieves. So it kind of goes against it, right? And also the relationships, like it can't be a coincidence, right? If you look at Collateral, The Insider, Heat, Miami Vice, he always has two.
Two.
He needs to have protagonist, antagonist. Mm-hmm. Like, and believe it or not every fucking movie is made that way. Like it's a formula that he picks. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I like it.
I know that we're done with our review, but if you think about how often Leo appears compared to how often any of Frank's friends or family appears, Leo is the second billing by far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leo is the guy who keeps talking to him and keeps giving him information and keeps telling him what he has to do next. Which goes on to my score, which is 8.89 reoccurring. Yes, I did a little dot over the 9. I what I really love about this film is that it shows you that those auteurs out there that start off with a film that is spellbinding from the get-go doesn't mean that it's a one shot in the dark that happened to hit a target. Michael Mann has proved himself from the beginning of his career, even to now, what an eye he has and what sense of story is. This is definitely one of those films that you could send to anybody and be like, can you see the beauty of this film? A lot of people will act like whoever the reviewer was who gave it one star and be like, oh, it's okay and stuff. Those are the people you can't be friends with anymore. But the reason I didn't give it any higher, which I should do, it's very close, is that, is this one of Michael Mann's best work? It's definitely one of his really good works, a very good benchmark. But I would say to people, go seek his later films as well, where he's perfected that storytelling, where he's perfected that eye of having characters live the life that he wants to show you and wants you to know about. So what is this? It's an 8.89 misspellings of male on an application form, which is M-A-L-E. The other one is what we put in post boxes.
Was this Frank writing it?
Yeah.
I love the way he fucking talks away. I love the way he talks in this. That's just the street, the Chicago. And I don't know if that accent is right, because there's a bit of Boston in there from what I... But yeah. It's just that every you know, move is not move, it's a move. Like, it's there's some energy behind the emphatic nature. It's like it's punchy. The dialogue is punchy. It's delivery, and it's synoptic. Like
it's like when he pulls off his ring and he just shoves it down on the table, and it's like if it's a matter of, you know, here, you know, it's great.
Oh, man,
what is this?
What is this? What is that? What is that?
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Steve.
This is a D flawless 3.2 carat emerald cut, Ricky.
You had to check your notes, didn't
you? Yeah, I did. Bye.